CBS Eye on the World, I'm John Batchelor. The headline about protests at justices' homes across the nation, but especially in the Washington area, this is a very large topic. And I welcome Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution. He teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago, recently on television to comment on the protests or the demonstrations. There are many words. However, there are legal matters here and there's history here to explore. Richard's comment in brief was that there's a fine line between protest and intimidation. Richard, a very good evening to you.
Yes.
Recently, headlines in the New York Times have called our attention to the fact that there are demonstrators' protests outside the homes of members of the Supreme Court. At the same time, we have photographs of a fence being constructed around the Supreme Court building, built in the 1920s, anticipating more disruption. You have guided me to understand that there is law, there is a Supreme Court decision, there are state laws, there's a federal law that speaks to all of this idea of protesting. I want to go to what I understand is the beginning of the case. This is a federal statute dated September 1950, 18 U.S.C. 1507. Whoever, with the intent of interfering with, obstructing, or impeding the administration of justice, or with the intent of influencing any judge, juror, witness, or court officer in the discharge of his duty, pickets or parades in or near a building housing a court of the United States, or in or near a building or residence occupied or used by such judge, juror, witness, or court officer, with such intent, uses any sound truck or similar device or resorts to any other demonstration in or near any such building or residence, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 1 year or both. Now, in English, that means that what I'm seeing in these photographs from the D.C. area come right up and over the line. Is that the fine line being crossed, Richard? Good evening to you.
Well, it turns out there's so many different lines. What you're talking about here is a very special statute, which is designed to preserve the independence of the judiciary against other forms of influence. There is also a general body of picketing law, which is generally far more permissive to what it is that people can say and do by way of protest. And in those cases, the line is supposed to be one which says you draw the distinction between providing information through picketing, often demonstrative on the one hand, and by intimidating people for doing certain things on the other. So if you brandish a stick, it may be one thing. If you brandish a copy of the Bible, it may well be another thing. It's highly contextual. It depends on the layout of the land and all sorts of other things. When it comes to the justices, I think what the position in the statute is, we don't want to worry about those sorts of things. We know that, in fact, the independence of the judiciary means it's supposed to be insulated from political pressure. Political pressure can often include protected speech under other circumstances. So what they're trying to do is to say, you can say whatever you want to say about the justices, and you have to say it in the newspaper, but you can't get close by and take this on. Somebody's going to challenge this, perhaps on the grounds that it's an infringement of First Amendment liberties. And then what you're going to have to do is to sort of balance the security issues of the system on the one hand, with the right of speech on the other. We know that it's always a balance because you're not allowed to picket in the Supreme Court when oral argument is taking place. You're not even allowed to enter as of right into the building in order to conduct a protest when it's not at stake. So this is an extremely murky area because we know what we're trying to achieve, but it's very muddy in terms of the way in which we're trying to achieve it. In my view, these pickets are most impolitic, probably also, I think, illegal. And what would be a true tragedy is the following sequence. People come out and they protest. And then when you see the final opinion, it's now 5-4. And that would suggest that somebody has yielded to the protest in question. That's just utterly unacceptable. And indeed, one of the reasons why it's so much more dangerous to have a leak than a published opinion, which is final, is that if, in fact, the opinion is not final, people can start to change their mind. So that increases the incentive of other people in order to threaten them and to get them to change their mind in one direction or another. If the opinion is already published, you can change the particular outcome. You can just protest it. So I think this is an extremely dangerous development. And I certainly think that people on the Supreme Court should say, the Chief Justice in particular, this is just not acceptable. More importantly, you need leaders in the Congress and the president to come out and say exactly the same thing. I mean, this is an issue which comes up in many different contexts. And there are also cases, including situations where the picketers have been anti-abortion protesters rather than pro-abortion protesters. And I've always taken the position that a kind of a bright line rule, which keeps them a certain distance from the doors of an abortion clinic, are being appropriate. But the Supreme Court, and what I think is one of its very worst opinions, a case called McCullen against Coakley from 2014, said, we don't want to have fixed rules. We want to let people do it until they've actually misbehaved, which is impossible to deal with administratively on one hand. And so you have a disagreement between the Chief Justice, who thinks these rules about abortion clinics are neutral, which they're not, and Justice Scalia, who knows that they're not, but nonetheless thinks that you don't want to give much scrutiny because it's content related. I think the correct rule is a bright line rule, which allows people to get close enough so they can be heard, but not close enough so that they can threaten to use force as appropriate. The Massachusetts statute in question called it 35 feet. I thought it was a very sensible compromise. And what we did is we have nine justices of the Supreme Court who don't believe in bright line rules in circumstances where case by case administration can prove to be fraught and dangerous.
I responded to these headlines, Richard, by looking at history and the danger of intimidation of a court, especially a Supreme Court. And I came up with four instances, and I welcome your comment because they're not directly analogous, but they suggest that a court intimidated is a court that is on the edge or the precipice of disaster. The first is the decision in 1857, March of 1857, the Dred Scott decision, which we all know was one of the predicates for the breakup of the Union and the disaster of the Civil War. There is plenty of historical evidence now to point that the newly elected president, James Buchanan of Pennsylvania, was in communication with members of the Supreme Court, one in particular, and had a warning about how the court was going to vote on how the court had voted on Dred Scott, led by Chief Justice Taney, Roger Taney. There's even reason to believe there was opportunity for the president to prepare his inaugural address on the basis of knowing what the Supreme Court would decide. The second instance is Franklin Delano Roosevelt's intention to increase the number of justices because of the difficulties he'd encountered in his first term during the Great Depression, leading to the court packing scandal and the doubts about Roosevelt that caused trouble in his second term. The third instance I have is not in this country. An attack on the Supreme Court in Colombia in 1985 by a guerrilla group called M19. The reason I bring that up is because a member of the M19 is now the leading candidate for the presidency of Colombia. Colombia, you know, is a strong ally of the U.S. Each of those instances do not speak to where we are right now, but they suggest that court influencing or intimidation leads to much worse afterwards than before. And is that license enough? Is that case enough to interfere in the present protests as likely unintended consequences afterwards?
Well, I think the current situation is completely different from all the others, which in some ways makes it more worrisome. The Dred Scott opinion was already written at the time that it was leaked to Buchanan. The question as to whether or not he tried to bring it about, I think, is much more difficult to prove than to say that he was given early warning. The language of the opinion is so ugly and so raw that nobody other than Taney himself could have written it. So I don't think that's a case in which the course of justice was influenced or even an attempt to do it. I think what Taney did is gave him a warning so he could prepare politically for it. And it's for that reason that James Buchanan is probably the worst president in the history of the United States, given that he would pave the way for the occurrence of the Civil War. And the court packing problem, I think, was in fact an extremely dangerous type of situation. And it was in that case that we have to thank the statesmanship of Charles Evans Hughes, an extremely important figure in the first half of the 20th century as a lawyer, as a justice, as a secretary of state, all the rest of that stuff, who essentially told the president that we are perfectly capable of handling our business. And all the reasons that you put forward for doing this are, in fact, false. And it's just a political situation to stack the court. I think in the short run that the Hughes statement actually basically took the wind out of the sail. And then Roosevelt was given the extraordinary opportunity to name a whole slew of justices right after all of that happened And so you get a rapid succession. You get William O. Douglas. You get Felix Frankfurter. You get Stanley Reed. You get Robert Jackson. I mean, you just got even James Byrne, who was the segregationist, were there. So that kind of made the thing disappear. This was proposed recently, and it was one of the things that the Biden Civil Supreme Court Commission considered. And it was amazing how hostile the comments were to the idea of expanding the court. And it was something which was treated with very light respect by the report, but it's essentially died, I think. The issue that is much more important in my mind is that of term limits. It's very difficult to figure out how you transition to that system. But I think for the most part in the United States, the courts that have term limits like the patent court and the tax court of 15 or 16 years, these are courts that seem to work fairly well. And that's probably a preferred model that's followed everywhere out the universe. You need a constitutional amendment to put that into place, I think, and that's going to be somewhat difficult to do. But those are ordinary discussions. What's odd about this particular case is it's just a form of mob rule, if you take it. And what is really frightening about the situation is that two can play. That is, you can start getting the people who are deeply supportive of the decision going around and picketing the house of Charles Schumer or somebody like that. This is all just a terrible mistake. And as I mentioned earlier in the McCullen case, the Supreme Court had a chance to draw some bright lines to minimize this effect, and it blew it because it simply believes too much in ad hocery as an administration of justice when, as I said in a book many years ago, simple rules for a complex world may not be the be-all and end-all of this stuff, but it's certainly the place where you want to begin. That is, you don't want to say, well, we're going to have traffic collisions. We'll just sort them out as they occur. You want to put a bright line down the middle of the road so that people don't go heading into one another, knowing full well that they're going to be calamities, catastrophes, and unanticipated situations where you may have to swerve into the opposite lane. That's the way in which you want to think about it. That's the way we should think about it. The political climate, I think, has gotten really ugly in the United States on this. And I think that the rhetoric on abortion, to some extent, contributes to that. I've long been more or less on the pro-life side of this particular debate. And it doesn't really matter whether I'm right or wrong for these purposes. What does matter, in effect, is that you try to make sure that you respect these decisions. I would also add there's another problem, which we didn't talk about yet, which I think is extremely important. There are many things wrong, I think, with the Alito opinion, but his criticisms of Roe, for the most part, are pretty much right on. But what he was extremely careful about doing was saying that Roe is a unique case. And so the idea that you're going to change the rules having to do with gay marriage or with contraceptive sales and so forth is completely false. Those were the two cases that most conspicuously said are not there. The decision with respect to Roe is not just a question of whether it was wrong, but whether it was so egregious that you want to overturn it. And people have many doubts about the constitutional underpinnings of both the decisions I've just mentioned, but nobody thinks that they created the kind of firestorm that happened from the day that Roe came down. I wrote about this case when I was a very young law professor at the University of Chicago back in 1973. And it was clear to me that the opinion was extremely weak in terms of what it does. And everybody was very, very surprised that it had even gone that particular way. What happens is it gets sort of solidified in the culture as a constant lightning rod. The defenders of Roe are furious and intense, and the attackers on it are exactly the same way. Turning it back to the political process, which is what Alito wants to do, maybe the best alternative that we have. But if he thinks that it's going to be a situation where it goes back to the state legislatures to deliberate and everybody else stands aside, that's a mistake.
Let's talk of the state legislatures, Richard, because that's part of a possible remedy here.
Yeah.
I want to turn to the political question because this isn't the last time there will be protests of the actions of the Supreme Court. Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, speaking of the fine line between protest and intimidation to judges of the Supreme Court, I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.